Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too. In these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. Say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes.
Why'd you linger here when there is no hope?
There is still hope.
Tempted to think there's no hope for overcoming some of the challenges of modern life? Ask an elf.
Or a hobbit.
Tune in Tuesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. with Milo Lomsdown at your service and...
Tawny Tenuvial, the resident KUCI Middle Earth Elf.
For What Would Arwen Do? On KUCI Irvine, 88.9 FM, and streaming live on KUCI.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at KUCI.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this July 6th, 2011 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. Sort of an eclectic morning this morning, short stories and nonfiction. I'm joined now by Alethea Black, and coming up in the second half hour, we'll be talking with leading a simpler life, kind of Japanese style. Robin Griggs Lawrence will be here with her book, Simply Imperfect. Alethea Black was born in Boston and graduated from Harvard in 91. Her work has won the Arts and Letters Prize, been cited as distinguished in the Best American Short Stories, and appeared in nearly a dozen literary magazines, including the Kenyon Review, the Antioch Review, and Narrative. I Knew You'd Be Lovely is her debut collection. It came out just yesterday. It's published by Broadway Paperbacks. I loved it, and it's my pleasure to welcome her this morning. Alethea, welcome.
Thank you.
Love, love, love this collection. So before we dive into it, tell me how the collection came about and a little bit about the stories inside to introduce our listeners to the book.
Well, I wrote them over the course of about the last 15 years, and I think that a lot of times as writers we're influenced by what we read, and I just really fell in love with writing through the form of the short story, and I would always read the annual anthologies that came out. So I found myself really responding to what I read, and these stories were born of that.
Were you ever deterred by, you know, everybody kind of telling you that the short story is a difficult way to make a living? And, I mean, novel writing is a difficult way to make a living. A short story is even harder. But is that ever kind of a factor in your thinking, the publishability of the short story?
You know, I think that you have to do what you feel called to do. And I did hear that from time to time, but I almost felt that I couldn't do anything about it, that this was what was speaking to me and through me, and so be it. Yeah, I can't control how it's received or those aspects of the equation I had no control over, but I just sort of plowed ahead.
Yeah. Do you think there's a novelist in short story writers or vice versa, or do you really sort of feel like you're called to one or the other, and the other, whatever you're not called to, is kind of an uphill battle?
You know, that's interesting. I think that both of the forms have more similarities than we realize. And, you know, a lot of times people speak of novelists learning how to write with the short story.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually was drawn to it because I like the way you can sort of hold the entire thing in your unconscious as you're working on it. And it wasn't an avoidance of the novel. But I do think that, you know, in some ways you can, you know, what I found was I would be working on stories, and then I also had a novel at the same time on my computer, and occasionally I would toggle back and forth. And when I got tired of one or kind of hit a roadblock in one, I would go to the other. So I don't know that they're as exclusive as we sometimes think.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Alethea Black. The book is I Knew You'd Be Lovely. Was this born of did you have a collection in mind when you were writing the stories, or did they just happen to all go together? Were there stories that you had to leave out because it didn't kind of fit the feel and style of the collection as a whole?
That's a great question. You know, I didn't have a collection in mind. In fact, I remember showing the title story, as it turns out, to someone at the Iowa Writers Workshop where I was for a summer, and I was very moved when they said, oh, you could have a great career for yourself. And I thought, career? This is just a little story. And so I wasn't planning on compiling them, but then you sort of reach a point where you've written 12,
right,
and you start to think, huh, maybe these could all go together between covers. And when I submitted the book, actually, it was just the first 12 stories that are in the collection now, and the 13th I wrote after the book was bought. And when I submitted the manuscript to my editor, I said, oh, there's another story that I just wrote, and please, you know, tell me your honest opinion, and we needn't include it if you don't think it belongs. But she liked it, fortunately, so that all came together as 13 in the end.
Me too. I like it too. So let's talk a little bit about that. I'm such a huge fan of the short story. As our listeners know, I bring short story writers on at every opportunity. And they are so much different. You know, I think the area of concern of short stories is so much different than novels, and kind of what they're trying to accomplish is so much different. And they're kind of amorphous little slippery creatures. You know, I feel like there are maybe more rules to the novel than there are maybe to short stories. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, if short stories are kind of like pornography, when you know it when you see what's working, but it's hard to put your finger on what's exactly making it working, what isn't making it work. Do you have a sense of that, having gone through 13 of these, when you know a short story is kind of doing its job, and perhaps when it isn't, and kind of how to wrap your mind around ways of fixing it when it's not?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not a big fan of rules in writing or in general, so perhaps that's one of the aspects that I like about the short story. And I remember having a conversation with a fellow writer where he said that the best way to write dialogue that didn't feel too crafted was to put in what you want and then go back and take out half of it. And that felt like a rule, so I immediately began writing a story that was about someone who wasn't editing herself at all. And but I do think that there is an intuitive sense, as you write, whether something is working and coming together, and that a lot of it is seeing in the dark, and you can sort of feel if it's coalescing in a way that's going to be worth moving forward or not. And sometimes right. you just have to keep the files on the computer of, oh, this might be fodder for something else, but as it stands now, it's not really working as a story per se.
Right, right. Well, one thing that I love about this collection are the author's notes at the end of it. So you take the 12 first short stories and talk a little bit about where they came from in your own head or kind of what inspired them, which I love. I'm a little I'm a little curious how stories in general sort of begin for you. If they begin with a character that's walking around in your head, if they begin with kind of a plot point that you want to explore, or if there's kind of a, I guess everyone has its own rhythm and style, but if you're more character driven or more plot driven when you're thinking about these,
you know, I can be sparked in a number of different ways, and I actually always have this miniature tape recorder with me, perhaps to the annoyance of my friends. And, you know, I'm always trying to remember and record different moments or snippets of dialogue or bumper stickers that seem worthy of contemplation. So, you know, it varies. Sometimes it can be a situation, you know, a conflict that I'm thinking about and want to work through in fiction, or a character or something I heard that got me to thinking and that I wanted to explore more. So the sparks vary, but I do feel strongly that, you know, occasionally I'll have stories that, or ideas that I have in these notebooks or on the tape recorder, and if it doesn't still excite me and inspire me, then I just won't pursue it, because I figure if it's not going to be compelling to me, then I don't want to bore anybody
right.
else with it.
It's funny because some of these sound like they have little germs of events that happened to you, that, you know, laryngitis sort of happened to you for a couple of weeks, a party sort of happened to you where you, I love this, where you wandered around with sort of a sandwich board on your chest and had people communicate with you through writing because you couldn't talk to them, so they decided, you know, they would also communicate to you through writing. I love that.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, I don't know if it's because it's my first book, but there is a lot of truth to it, and it definitely draws from what I knew and what I know, and that is based on actual experience. So the author's notes felt fairly natural because I did directly use so much of real life.
See, the interesting thing to me when I'm thinking about this is, and I've had this experience where if you're trying to write about something that literally happened, it's almost harder for me to get to the truth of it through the facts of it than it is if I'm inventing something whole cloth. It sometimes feels more emotionally authentic, because if it really happened to you, sometimes, you know, you can't say enough about it. You can't wrap your mind around the whole emotional experience of it, so somehow it rings false. I wonder if that's any part of your experience as well.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that's very, very true. And a lot of times, to actually convey a deeper truth, you have to change what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had people read stories where they recognize certain elements of the plot, but feel surprised or even in one instance betrayed by what really happened, by what happens in the story versus what really happened.
Right.
Because to pursue you know, to really say something. You can't be hemmed in by the facts. You have to give yourself that liberty, and a lot of times you will begin with what really happened, or you'll begin with an actual person, but of course things will change over the course of writing.
Right, right. And so much of these stories, so many of these stories have so much gorgeous humor. I mean, they're just hilarious humor. I mean, it's obvious that you love to play with language because so many of your characters love to play with language. I imagine that that's just a voice that you yourself can't escape from, but your characters take the best parts of your humor and wit and subtlety with them. That's really lovely.
Thank you.
The other author note that sort of struck me was that you said that you'd gotten rejected from The Atlantic a couple of times, but very sweetly, and they said they liked stories where something happens, and so you set out to write a story where something happened, with the sentence, "Something was about to happen." Do you ever write with a mind towards what will be published, or write directly towards what you think a magazine is looking for, or was this kind of a one-off thing where you were trying to serve up something to The Atlantic, but that's sort of the unusual case scenario?
I don't tend to. I think it's never a winning game to play to the marketplace, yeah. And you have to write what speaks to you most deeply. And in fact, a lot of times when I was writing these stories, I felt like much of my voice was unfashionable in that, you know, I'm not afraid of a little closure and I'm not afraid of a little hope. And sometimes you get to the end of a story and you think, did a page fall out of this? Did somebody vandalize my magazine? And my stories tend not to be like that, although of course there are excellent stories that do that. But in that one instance with The Atlantic, I had, I had had this correspondence and this relationship, and I too naturally like stories where things happen as well. So I just sort of amplified that in working on that one story that started something was about to happen. He could feel it. But in general, I think that that's not. I think you have to be very inner directed with these things.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Alethea Black. The book is I Knew You'd Be Lovely. Let's talk a little bit about endings. And I love your observation that sometimes you're reading a story and you feel like a page has fallen out of the middle of it. That is sort of a characteristic of a lot of short stories. And a lot of these stories end on your right, sort of a hopeful note and sort of a... But a lot of them are your character sort of crossing a threshold. And you could almost feel like, the story is just about to begin when it ends. Tell me about endings in short stories and sort of when you know you're done and if you overwrite it and then have to cut back on it and realize that the story probably ended, a page and a half before it, you allowed it to end and then maybe cut it off. That's always the feeling I get from short stories.
Mm. Well, I love endings. I really enjoy when you reach that moment and you can feel it. I actually prefer the moment where even if there were text afterwards, you would know that word was the right conclusion to that particular story. But at the same time, it's difficult because as you're writing, you're not writing toward a specific final sentence, and you're often not even writing toward a specific scene. So you need to, it's an adventure with yourself. You need to be able to feel when you've reached the ending. And I haven't had instances where I've written past the ending, but I have had occasion where a friend of mine, a fellow writer and very, very helpful reader named Jeff Jackson, has said to me, oh, this moment is your ending. And it happens here on page 10, but actually this should be the ending on page 13. And he was absolutely right. So that type of thing has happened, but I think that it should definitely resonate, for you and for the reader. And I also like it when at the end you can sort of go back. There's a natural feeding back to the first sentence, mm-hmm. or the title.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I love that too. I also love gifted readers who can point out to you what your story is. I think it's about this. And you're like, yeah, you're right.
We love gifted readers.
Love gifted readers. you know, the other thing you do so beautifully is writing from the other point of view. You write beautifully from a male perspective, from a married perspective, from a divorced perspective. Is it almost easier to inhabit the other than it is to inhabit the self when you're trying to get into these people?
Another great question. Isn't it always?
Isn't it always right?
I don't know. Is it easier to inhabit the other? Well, I think that both have their perils and their joys. You know, I, for whatever reason, seem to have a plastic mind or approach to the voice of a story, but I don't know that it would be easier to inhabit the other, because really to write the other well, you have to connect with something in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly more fun for you as the writer from a variety perspective to
right.
not always write from your own familiar self.
Right, right. You'd make an excellent middle-aged guy, I think.
Why, thank you.
Tell me about difficult characters in this collection, characters that gave you problems, people that you couldn't understand and maybe, you know, had to write around them for a while to try and figure out their psychology and how you dealt with people who you couldn't quite access, or, you know, maybe that didn't happen, but if it did, I'd love to hear about it.
No, that did, actually. And there's one story where there's a character of the mother who was based on my mother, and yet not her at the same time. And so I didn't know, the boundaries there were fluid and were difficult, because she had to be someone different than herself in the story, and yet I knew that because it was a very intimate and personal story, that people would be reading her as my mother, and that she herself would be reading her as my mother. So that required a little bit of thoughtfulness.
That's a good word. Finessing.
Yeah.
Likewise, were there stories that didn't quite reveal themselves to you? You know, that you were writing, you know, I find this, that you're writing something you really love, but there's no substance underneath the floating boat, you know?
Well, actually, that story that you mentioned, The Thing Itself, where I was inspired by this comment about The Atlantic and how they loved stories where things happen, and I came up with that opening line, something was about to happen, he could feel it. Well, that was it. I did not know what was going to happen. And so that was difficult in its own way, too, because, as you know from the opening paragraph, that sense of suspense is only amplified, and I thought, well, I better really make something
right.
happen.
Now it has to pay off, darn it.
Right. Now that I've set the stakes, I certainly better deliver. And I truly didn't know when I started out. I was so grateful with that story that it was able to deliver to me, because I was uncertain, you know, what that something was going to be when I started out.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Alethea Black. The book is I Knew You'd Be Lovely. You're so great at titling stories, too, and I think titles are tricky. And the worst thing about short stories is that you have to do it, you know, 13 times instead of just once for a novel. A lot of the titles come from phrases that are in the stories themselves. Talk a little bit about your process of titling. Do you write the story and then kind of look back over it and see if there are catchphrases that sort of stand out to you as good titles, or how do you do this so well?
You know, thank you for the compliment. I have a terrible time with titles, and I have a terrible time with character names. I always have this cargo of associations with every name. So I have to go through, I have a working list of names on my computer, and I often have to go through dozens before one fits. And the same thing with titles. In fact, the title of the collection was delivered by my editor. You know, she selected that title from one of the stories in it. But I have a hard time with titles, because I want, you know, you want to sort of strike with a glancing blow the truth of the story. You don't want to give too much away, and there's so many factors at work that they often give me trouble, and I'll have, you know, I've had stories that have cycled through five different titles. I've had stories where someone else delivered the title, as I say, or the title didn't reveal itself until the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I find them to be not the easiest part of the process.
I don't think you're alone in that. I think that they're the easiest part of the process. And we touched on this a little bit earlier, but dialogue is another thing that I think you do well, and I think is hard to do. Do you read this out loud to kind of get characters right? Do you tape record, like transcribe people's conversations in Starbucks? How do you hear these conversations so well?
Well, I think the dialogue is so important, and I've had two of the stories in this collection were adapted as one-act plays. By Mayor Ribolo, who's wonderful and has been a wonderful help with this book as well. And I think that I took that as high praise, that enough happened through dialogue that kind of translation suggested itself. Mm. I read everything out loud. You know, as that's how I edit, so it's good that I live alone, because often it's late at night, and I think you have to. I think you hear awkwardness in both the prose, you know, in both exposition and certainly in dialogue. And I wouldn't say that I transcribe conversations in Starbucks, but, you know, of course you're listening all the time as you move through the world. And if, you know, there's such an art to it, to making it authentic, doesn't actually equate to making it the way people truly speak.
Right.
But I try hard to get the dialogue thing right.
It is an art. And I also want to talk about ordering the collection. Because, you know, I think in short story collections, the stories have to tell a story, and then the collection has to tell a story. And I know you can't just, you know, throw 13 stories down on your floor and pick them up in whatever order you pick them up in. You know, you kind of have to have a pacing and a cadence and a light and a dark balance. Tell me a little bit about figuring out the ordering for this, for the collection.
Well, you know, the order changed. I submitted it under one order. And then as I was doing the final review and reading it aloud to myself, I said, oh, no, I don't know. I want that story to come before that story. And this was fairly far along in the process, and I thought, oh, I haven't been a high-maintenance customer up until now, and I don't want to annoy everyone at this point. But I did make a plea, which they listened to, fortunately. But it's true, you want the collection itself to have an arc, and I've been told, and I appreciate and agree, that there's a unity of voice to the book, that even though the topics are different and the characters are different, that there is something that inheres.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that for that reason, the order was especially important.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that you paid attention to it. I think that the people, you know, they may not consciously realize that they're being affected by it, but that it does play a significant role.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Before we end our time, I'd love to have you read to us. Can you read to us just a moment from the book?
Sure. I think I'll read the beginning of the title story, which is "I Knew You'd Be Lovely." His birthday was only 3 days away, and Hannah had to find Tom the perfect gift. Prescient, ingenious, unique, unforgettable. All month, she'd been looking for clues from the universe. She scoured the internet, studied mail order catalogs, stole peeks inside other people's briefcases. Finally, she found herself resorting to desperate measures, and was trying to read the minds of the men seated across from her on the commuter train. She stared at them under the bright lights and asked telepathically, "What do you want most in the whole world that costs under $200 and would fit in a box?" Her psychic acumen, however, was proving to be as dim as her prospects. To make matters worse, she'd been caught squinting purposefully at strangers, a posture she quickly tried to pass off as an attempt to read the contact lens advertisements. By the time she got to work, she had the kind of headache that made her think she might in fact need contact lenses. She was also on the verge of full-scale panic. Hannah knew that if she didn't find the gift that demonstrated she, better than anyone, understood the very contours of Tom's soul, she could lose him. There was another woman. Tom had done everything he could to assure Hannah the woman was just a pen pal, and described what they had as that clever little word, a correspondence. But it was easy for Hannah to tell that her nemesis was no mere pal of the pen. She was more like a Playboy centerfold with stationery. Tom met the woman 6 months ago at a summer writing seminar in Prague. Hannah's first warning sign came when she was relating the story to her best friend. He met her at some summer camp. What'd they do, sit around, toast marshmallows, and sing by the campfire? It wasn't a summer camp. It was a writing workshop. Oh, Nihon said, shaking out her cigarette match. So they sat around, drank whiskey, and screwed.
That's great. I love it. That was Alethea Black reading from I Knew You'd Be Lovely, from the story I Knew You'd Be Lovely. I love it. Last minute words of writing advice for writers?
You know, I love Annie Dillard's advice on the subject where she says, give it all, give it now.
I like that too. I like that too. Alethea, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Robin Griggs Lawrence will be here for the second half hour with Simply Imperfect, revisiting the Wabi Sabi House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCI Talk writersonwriting.org. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can visit iTunes. We've had some problems with iTunes, but we are back up there, so don't give up on us. We are under College University Radio. And I think there are two links there. Try our most recent one under the Pen on Fire Writers on Writing link, and that should lead you to our new shows. You can always visit Barbara's website. All of our podcasts are up there, and that is updated frequently. It is penonfire.com. You can get direct downloads as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows. We've got the great speaker series that's still going on and going strong. All of that information is up there and more. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Robin Griggs Lawrence. Robin is editor-at-large for Mother Earth News, Natural Home and Garden, and the Herb Companion. Herb Companion, good grief. A prolific writer and speaker on topics ranging from green building and ecological design and to organic gardening, she has been instrumental in popularizing the Japanese philosophy of wabi-sabi in the Western audience. Simply Imperfect is a fully revised and updated edition of the Wabi Sabi House, aimed at it moving past our belief in life, liberty, and the pursuit of stuff to finding beauty in austerity, serenity, and authenticity. It's published by New Society Publishers. It's my pleasure to welcome her this morning. Robin, hello.
Hello.
Hello. This was such a serene, gorgeous read. The book itself is gorgeous. I love it.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah. So let's start with definitions first, so we can all be on the same page. Tell us about wabi sabi generally, and what it means.
Wabi sabi is the Japanese art of finding beauty in things that are imperfect and impermanent and rustic and aged, and it goes all the way back to really the 15th, 16th century in Japan, and it stems from the tea ceremony. So it's basically the idea of, you know, a very simple, very rustic ceremony that emphasizes a lot about simplicity and comfort and hospitality. So it's kind of taking those principles and applying them to creating then a nurturing home.
That's beautiful. So it's not a style. It's not a home decoration philosophy. It's sort of a lens by which you look at the world.
That's a great way to say it. That's exactly right. It's, you know, people will say, oh, I get it. It's shabby chic. And, you know, that's a piece of it. That's kind of the superficial vision of it, but that, you know, there's so much more to it. So it really, what comes into play here is a lot of slowing down and simplifying and uncluttering and really finding ways to create a simpler, more, you know, beautiful home, but based less on materialism and sleekness and new things and more on appreciating the old and things that have withstood the test of time.
Right. Fortunately, I live in Orange County, the home of this. we really embody this.
The home of not.
Yeah, so what are the biggest enemies to this philosophy? Sort of things that we need to kind of specifically avoid if you're, you know, especially for our Orange County audience, that it's slick and plastic is what we're all about. So.
Well, I think the first thing is just first of all, uncluttering. You know, we especially in our culture, and it's everywhere today, not just in Orange County. But you know, we have more choices in one afternoon of shopping than our grandparents had probably in their entire lifetime. So, you know, first of all, it's just a changing of the mindset to have to have. You know, the neighbors have this, so I'm going to get it. So it's a changing of a mindset from that to really starting to create space in our homes. So instead of adding stuff, you know, it's almost an anti-decorating book in a way, because it's not telling you to go out and find things that all go together and put them in your home, but it's more saying, first of all, what can you get rid of? You know, most of us have too much stuff in our homes, and so it's a paring down, it's a simplifying, and then, you know, it's a question of not having to go buy things that all match, not having to go buy things that are brand new, but really enjoying the hunt and finding things that are aged, finding heirloom pieces from your family, finding things with a little more soul to bring into your home as opposed to the, you know, I ordered this from a catalog and everything matches everything else.
Right. I assume that a couple of different things are feeding into this as well now with that, like the organic food movement and slow cooking and kind of a return to basics and non-processed foods. And I keep bringing up food, but I'm sure there are other examples of this as well.
Well, there's food is a huge part of it. And I think, you know, when we think home, we think meals and, you know, we think gathering around the table for meals. And so, you know, food is an easy way to kind of start sliding into the whole wabi-sabi mentality because it's something we do every day. And it's becoming more and more important and also easier to get local food. You know, that there's you eat differently when you have a connection to the person who grew your food, or if you know exactly where that food grew, or, you know, you've had a conversation with the farmer who grew it. It's a completely different connection to your food, and I think that's a very easy wabi-sabi step. That's a great place to start. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is making food a meditation. So, you know, not only in the acquisition of your food, but also in the preparation of it. And perhaps instead of using the machines, instead of using your electric choppers or electric blenders, you cut things by hand and take some time with it and really enjoy the beauty of creating a meal. So it's really about just taking it down. It's so simple. Mm. But we have kind of complicated everything from our meals to our homes. And so it's really just how can I make this more simple? And how can I just see it as an opportunity for meditation and an opportunity for connection and appreciate it for that as well?
Yeah, yeah. So I was thinking of it in terms of writers and the writerly life and what this sort of means for writers, how to incorporate this philosophy into your work as writer. And I assume you have thoughts on that because you write so much yourself.
Well, boy, I have to say, I would have to say that writing a book is kind of an inherently wabi-sabi act.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's lonely.
It's
definitely a lonely...
it's slow.
There's a solitude that I think a writer needs to create for herself that is intrinsically wabi-sabi. You know, in wabi-sabi, there's a bit of something of a melancholy, a loneliness, a really appreciating, you know, being alone and having that time and the solitude. And so in that, I think, is very much a wabi-sabi act. I'd say books in themselves are a wabi-sabi act. They're slow. They're, you know, an ancient art form that still exists. And so, you know, just that creation is also wabi-sabi. But I think for me, the biggest thing that wabi-sabi brought to me is a beginning. I'm definitely not there yet. I am a reforming perfectionist, but letting go of that insane perfection that I think drives all writers to, you know, keep going back, make it perfect, make it perfect, make it perfect. And I will do that to some extent, but I've also am learning to trust a little bit more my instincts and, you know, let it be slightly imperfect, which I think allows people to relate.
Right,
more
right.
To it.
Is it also sort of a shedding of computers in favor of pens and longhand writing? Or?
Yeah, I just started doing that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for so many years, once we kind of got onto computers, that's just, I always thought I had to do that. And I moved myself into a basement office and found that I didn't want to work anymore. I didn't like going down to the basement. So I started taking my notepad and going outside and finding that my writing changes in that format. And that's, again, ultimately wabi-sabi.
That's great. That's great. Tell me a little bit about your decision to update the original book. So you wrote The Wabi-Sabi House in 2004, and so this is kind of an updated, revised version. Tell me about that, the decision to re-put this out in the world and how the look and feel of this book differs from the original.
It differs a lot. You know, it's funny. The book came out in 2004. I started work on it in 2001, right after 9/11, when, you know, we were at that moment. And I really believed we were going to move into nesting and to the simplifying. And, you know, there was kind of that moment where America was rethinking itself and what are our priorities. But unfortunately, what we kind of went to was patriotic shopping. And, you know, we got bigger credit card bills and more debt and more materialism. And so the timing, honestly, was just pretty wrong. Mm. There was it was more of a cult following at that point than it was, you know, kind of in the mainstream zeitgeist. And so when things really started to economically go downhill in 2008, and all of a sudden people were starting to pay attention to frugality and simplifying, and homes started getting smaller, and I realized this is the moment for my book. This book was, you know, probably 7 years too early. So I rushed to redo it, and I thought that would be easy. I thought I would just sit down and I would, you know, update a couple. I got divorced. I moved to a townhouse. I have simplified myself since I wrote that book in 2004. And so, you know, I thought I just would put a couple things in. But as any writer, editor, I realized that the book needed a complete overhaul. And so I changed it. And I basically gave it a kind of, I turned it into more of a 12-step program for cultivating wabi-sabi, as opposed to more of a kind of overall prosy. And so I'd say it's definitely more, it's a bit more perhaps reader service-y than the first one was more philosophical. This one is, I'd say, organized in more of a way that somebody really could create a wabi-sabi home from it.
Yeah, one of the things I really appreciate about this are all the concrete suggestions of here are five things you can do today, you know.
Well, I think that's, because you can get so caught up in a philosophy, and it's beautiful, and it's lovely, and it can go on forever, and, you know, there's all these different tentacles to it, but if you kind of get done with the book and think, well, that's lovely, but I have no idea where to begin, then the book wasn't successful. And so I really, you know, wanted to give people, here's one thing you can go do, and they'll feel empowered, and then they'll do the next thing.
Right. Maybe give us five things that what people can do to kind of get people pushed off in the right direction here this morning.
Well, I think, you know, one of the super simple things you can do is just start, you know, kind of rebelling a bit against the machine. And so maybe one day a week, instead of loading the dishwasher, wash the dishes by hand, and do it with a significant other. So it's not just kind of an opportunity for some moving meditation, but an opportunity to connect with someone that you may not have the opportunity to just stand and wash dishes and talk with all of the time. I think that's a great thing. You know, also just, you can do the same thing with sweeping the floor. Consider it a meditation. So, you know, maybe go for the broom over the loud dirt devil. Another great thing is that I've started doing that has made a huge difference in my life is, and stemming from Japanese tea ceremony and the hospitality piece of it, is when someone comes to your door, invite them in and offer them a cup of tea. And this sounds like such a, you know, little thing, but so often I have people come to the door to pick up their kids who have been visiting my kids or whatever, and, you know, we may not know each other very well, and you kind of stand there as them, and there's that kind of awkward moment where it's, you know, oh, hey. And so I've been inviting people in for tea, and they're kind of surprised. But they come in, and I've made so many great new friends that way. So I'd say just that simple thing. And then another super simple thing to do is I keep a vase. It's one vase that I absolutely love. It's a, you know, handmade vase by a potter that I know in North Carolina. But I always keep that vase filled with something that is from within a mile of my home. Mm-hmm. So it may be in the winter, it's going to be bare branches. In the fall, it will be beautiful autumn leaves. In the spring, you know, we get to do blooms. Right now, it's a little bit harder because it's July and everything's just kind of green. So I'm having to be a little bit. But basically what this does is it keeps me in tune with the seasons and where we are. It keeps me in touch with where I live and what's happening right outside my door. And it keeps me from going and buying, you know, hothouse flowers that are full of pesticides that came over from somewhere in South America. So it's just a super simple little way to have that little wabi-sabi spot that's always filled in your house.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I also liked your suggestions about not using store-bought containers on your store to transfer things into, you know, nicer bowls or things rather than throwing the ketchup bottle on the table. And
You know, little things like that that my kids are always just kind of annoyed about, but I think they're going to appreciate when they get older. You know, it's that, yeah. So,
it makes a difference.
So instead of, you know, putting the sour cream from the plastic
right.
thing into the bowl, or we always use cloth napkins, and, you know, it's just little things like that, that not only, you know, it's kind of an environmentally friendly thing to do. We're not using paper. We're not using disposables. But it's also just nicer.
Right.
And I think they've grown up with that, so they don't completely realize that it's, you know, not just a pain in the rear, but that there's simple little touches, and they don't have to be expensive, and they don't have to be grand, but there's just that kind of little touch that says, you know what, I care enough about you that I want you to have a cloth napkin.
Yeah, yeah. Throw away the coffee mug from your insurance company with their logo.
This is one that I think, you know, this is how you start your day, whether you drink coffee, tea, or, you know, whatever beverage it is that you use to start your day. This is the first item I always interact with is my coffee mug.
Right, right.
And, you know, for so many years, I was just kind of unconscious about it. And it was, I think it was something from, you know, an excavation company or something ridiculous, that it wasn't pretty, it didn't make me happy, it didn't even feel that great in my hands. And so my kids gave me, 1 year for Mother's Day, a wonderful, just handmade pottery, heavy mug that has people dancing on it, and it just makes me happy in the morning, and it's the first thing I interact with. And, you know, I like just enjoying that mug and just sitting quietly drinking my coffee. That's kind of my morning meditation in a lot of ways, and so I want it to be on something beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. My guest this morning is Robin Griggs Lawrence. The book is Simply Imperfect. It is it's beautiful. The look and feel of the book is consistent with the theme. So the photos are sepia. There's some great photos in here. They're sepia toned. It's quiet. It's a book that sort of feels good in your hands. Maybe I'm hoping it's on recycled paper. Probably
it is.
Yeah. Good. Good. Now, did you have a lot of say in the look and feel of the book itself?
I did. I did most of these photographs with a photographer who I had worked with for many, many years, Joe Coca. So we spent a lot of time on location and also in his studio. Some of them are pulled from my time as editor-in-chief of Natural Home Magazine, where I was visited hundreds of amazing, amazing homes. And so some of my favorite homes from those shoots are in there. And, you know, it's just so much fun, because Wabi Sabi is really something that it helps people to see the photos as much as it does, I think, to read the words in something like this, because there's a kind of picture is a thousand words sense to this, that you look at a photo and you can go, oh, I get that.
Right.
And that's just a magic that can't always happen with just words.
Right, right. Tell me a little bit about the research that went into this.
Oh, boy. I went all the way back to 12th century Japan, really. I spent some time in Japan. I got to go to learn tea ceremony with some tea masters. I spent some time with some potters and Zen masters, and visited traditional Japanese farmhouses or minka to understand the sense of those. I went way back into the oldest tea books I could find, and I also spent a couple of days at the Smithsonian Institution, because back in the 60s, House Beautiful had run a couple of special issues on a very wabi-sabi-related concept called Shibui. And so all of that editor's notes were in boxes at the Smithsonian, and they pulled all those out for me and let me dig through those, which was just, as a writer, that was maybe my most amazing experience, was I felt like it was, you know, pulling something that was kind of lost in an archive, and I was able to give it new life in the pages of this book, and that to me is the magic of writing, is to pull something that may have been lost in obscurity and put it out there again.
I love where this question takes writers. You know, I mean, if people do just the most wonderful things in service of their books, and, you know, I've had writers lock themselves in concentration camps for
wow.
you know, 3 or 4 days at a time, and
yep.
your experiences, these are just, it's wonderful.
This is why we do it. I mean,
right, right.
Clearly not for the money, and we do it, I think, for these experiences, because how else would you get to do this? You know, I remember thinking that when I was in Japan, just what else in my life could I do that would give me this opportunity to be sitting here with this most amazing tea master, and, you know, who am I?
And just because I'm writing this book, I got to go do that. And I was just, humbled and thrilled.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is. It's really,
it is.
It's just so much fun where people, and how open people are to taking you under their wing and showing you all sorts of, they want the art to stay alive too. So they're more than welcome to bring you into their world for a while. I love that too.
Yes.
That's great. So you also blog. I know you write a lot for journal magazines. Is there is kind of a subconscious thing in your head where you feel like you have to keep your platform going, or is it all just stuff you naturally love to do, or is there a sense that in this world as a writer you've really kind of got to keep your irons in lots of different fires to keep your platform up?
I think that you have to keep your irons in lots of different fires, especially in this day and age.
Yeah.
You know, even when the book first came out in 2004, there weren't as many venues as there are now. You know, I really, I'm getting it out there on all the different, the different blog sites and, always looking for, is there another place where I could, what are the magazines that fit this that I should keep? But I what I found is when the book first came out in 2004, I did a big, huge, huge publicity blitz. And then I went back to my day job because I really had to. I definitely saw the fall off. So I think you just have to keep it out there all the time. And there's, every time I turn around, there's a different sort of venue for how to do that. So it's a full-time job, I think, just keeping up with all of that.
Yeah, no kidding. any last-minute words of advice for writers?
Just do it, believe in yourself, and write what is authentic to you. I think, really my success did not come to me until I knew what I loved and said, I don't care if this is commercially or economically viable. This is what feels right to me, and this is what I'm going to put out there. And you can tell.
Yeah, you can tell. Right. Mm-hmm. This was wonderful. Thank you so much,
Thank
Robin.
Thank you. This was fabulous.
That was Robin Griggs Lawrence. The book is Simply Imperfect. It's out now. It's very lovely. That's all the time we have for today. I'm off for a while, but Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning and many Wednesday mornings thereafter. I'll be back towards the end of August, so I will miss this a lot. But until next time, many thanks for joining me. Have a great day. I just don't wanna be free, no.